This is the show that helps transform the experience. Because when you transform the experience, you transform your business and the world around you. I'm your host, Jason S. Bradshaw, and today's guest is a global force in customer-centric transformation. But his story didn't begin on a stage or in a boardroom. It began with a question that I'm sure most of us have asked. Why does it have to be this way? Lior Arousi was once an executive inside a Fortune 500 company, watching decisions being made that left customers frustrated and employees disengaged. Rather than complain, he chose to challenge the status quo, and that choice changed absolutely everything. He walked away from a prestigious career to ignite a movement that now spans over 200 brands across 21 countries, from Mercedes-Benz to the Royal Caribbean. Lior has helped companies turn apathy into empathy, process into purpose, and service into something that inspires loyalty for life. So let's lean in, because what you're going to hear isn't just strategy. It's a story, it's a shift, it's a call to lead with heart. Let's welcome to the show, Lior Arousi. Lior, welcome.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Absolute pleasure, and congratulations on yet again being announced as one of the global thought leaders on customer experience. And that's not surprising, considering the number of books that you've authored and the number of organizations that you've helped deliver sustained transformations in the way that they operate. Your latest book, Dare to Author, is just one of the many pieces of your legacy story. Can you share with our listeners today a little bit about the book Dare to Author?
Sure. Dare to Author was born based on a very interesting experience. As part of our transformation work, we discovered very quickly that the cause of customer centricity, although understood by many others and many employees, somehow companies and organizations are failing to shift towards that behavior. And we're trying to understand what the issue is. Now, there is a body of work around change management that talks about the fact that people are afraid of the unknown future, and that's why they refuse to change. Our experience have actually shown a totally different issue. When we dig deeper with the many employees, we found that their real struggle is when the moment they hear the word change, they equate it with a negative judgment on their past performance. So if you were the cashier at a bank and now the bank shut it down because of digital transformation, what are you going to do with the last 20 years of you being a cashier? You just heard that being a cashier at the bank was a mistake. Jason, you need to take those 20 years and write them off and call them a failure. And this is too big to process. So we found out that the real issue is really helping people connect the past to the future in some kind of a cohesive story and write the next chapter. So we found ourselves oftentimes helping people not act as victims toward change, which is their default reaction, and choose to be the hero. Doing that is writing a new chapter in your book, respecting the previous chapter, building on the past chapter. But that is a skill set that most people don't possess. So what happens is change comes, you act as a default victim, you resist the change, as opposed to rising up and saying, where's the opportunity here? And that's what the book is all about. It's calling people to recognize that when we do not author our own story, that story will be authored to us and we'll be the central victim of that story.
Yeah, that makes absolute sense to me. Now, I'd like to start somewhere a little bit simpler for our audience. How would you explain customer experience to a 10-year-old?
Oh, very simple. So there are two ways of engaging with a customer. Inspiration or desperation. Either you create something that people want and then they'll stand in line for it, or you have something that everybody else has and then you're desperately trying to reduce your price in order to convince people to work with you. So very simple, inspiration or desperation. If you're having struggles with getting customers and with deeper discounts, you're in desperation. Your product is not good enough. If you are having customers standing in line and asking for more, you're an inspiration. Very simple.
It makes perfect sense. Now, of course, your career didn't just happen overnight. Your success has been built over working in the trenches, doing the hard work that's delivered sustainable transformative change. Can you take us back to a moment when you realized that customer experience wasn't just a function, but rather a mission? What happened?
in fact, multiple moments, but I'll tell you a small story that will maybe illustrate the point for you. I received a call one day. I was working for a technology company specializing in customer service software, and I got a call from our sales director in Holland, and he said, "Look, Leo, disaster, our best customer just received the worst customer service award in Holland." I said, "Maybe you have a problem with your English. You meant the best." He said, no, it's the worst. I said, "There's no such an award." He said, "In Holland there is." And I'm like, "You got to be kidding me." I said, "You know what? People will forget about it tomorrow." He said, "No, they won't, because the magazine that awarded them this award plays a 10-piece orchestra in front of their office, and they are playing funeral songs." I'm like, "Oh my gosh, I have to call my client and just check how he's doing." And I asked him, "Jan, what happened? We just installed the latest technology. You are ahead of everybody else in Holland. You are absolutely advanced against everyone else." And he said to me, "Leon, even a fool with a tool is still a fool." And I said, "What?" He said, "I bought the technology, but I didn't do the work. I didn't do the homework. I didn't do the strategy. I didn't do the operation. I didn't do the cultural transformation." And I realized how many of them are buying technologies and thinking that technologies will service customers. Technology does not service customers. People service customers. Okay? And that insight was echoing to me with other clients that I started to talk to. I'm selling them tools, but I'm fooling them because they're buying the shortcut without doing the hard work and actually committing to serving the customer. And the notion that the customer is really at the center of it is lost on people. They treat the customer as a mean to an end, not the end game of the organization. That's when I realized it's much bigger than just customer service, taking calls and being kind or solving problems faster or average handling time or all these types of things. People just forgot that the purpose of an organization is to create and retain a customer.
Yeah, I think that really reinforces an important point. It's perhaps easy, and perhaps it's even expected at times for organizations to go out and buy that next best shiny piece of technology. You can remember there was a whole movement at one point around, let's get chatbots on websites because that will solve all of our problems. But at the end of the day, it is people wanting to be served by people. They're wanting human experiences and human outcomes. Technology can enable us to do that in a more efficient way, but it can't replace us.
Let me give you an example, Jason, right, if I may, okay?
Of course.
I did work for a major bank, and they installed a whole host of self-service tools, and they wanted to see the impact of those self-service tools on the customers. And we took the customers that adopted them the most, and we actually measured a very interesting thing. We asked them, what is their score of the value the bank provides to them before and after? So before, when they were serviced by a real human being, they scored it 8 out of 10. But when the bank shifted to self-service, they actually ranked it 5 out of 10. And the bank was shocked. And I said, there's nothing shocking here, guys, because there is a cardinal rule that will never change. The person who serves me will keep the margin. When you serve me, you keep the margin. When I serve myself, I expect you to reduce your price because you practically outsourced your sales and service to me. And by the way, Jason, we do that in supermarkets today. I don't know if you were planning that as part of your career, but I am now working in supermarkets. I'm back. I'm the cashier. I have to tell you a story. I was at a certain airport and I did my own scanning and bagging. And then right before I'm paying, a screen came up saying, would you like to leave a tip to the person who helped you? People misplace this notion. And now we're talking about AI and chatbots and everything else. Guys, beware of self-service. Self-service gives a lot of power to the customer, but the margins are shifting with that.
Yeah, I really love that phrase. He or she who serves is the one that keeps the margin.
Yeah.
And so you've said in the past that apathy is one of the biggest destroyers of value in business. Can you share a time with us where you saw an indifference that ultimately cost the company dearly?
So I have to tell you, when I go to organizations, I have a very interesting measure, okay? And the measure is the cynicism level in the organization, okay? And I remember sitting in a workshop, conducting a workshop, and there was a very cynical vice president sitting there. And I asked him to stand up and leave the room and not come back. And he stares at the CEO, and the CEO's, I don't know what's going on. And he said, why are you kicking me out? And I said, because you're cynical. And he said, yeah, that's my working tool. That's how I survive the work. I said, this is exactly my problem. It's not a working tool. It's a destruction tool. You're thinking that you're being funny with your silly jokes, but let me tell you what you're really telling the whole audience here. Here's what you're telling them. Don't bother innovate. Don't bother try new things. Don't bother looking to the future. You took a 5-kilo hammer and you crashed their dreams and inspiration with your cynical jokes, because cynicism says, why bother? Nothing will ever change. Cynicism is the excuse not to dream and not to try. So I cannot allow you to be here, because I'm yet to see an entrepreneur who succeeded, who said, my secret sauce to success was cynicism. Apathy, that's why in my book, I talk about two positions. You're either a victim or you're a hero. A victim, you hide behind the process and you blame the process and you blame the system and you blame what they won't let me do. Or you rise up to the better version of yourself and say, I'm owning this. This is mine. These are that two modes of performance in organizations, mediocre and superpower or exceptional performance. And you know the difference between them? Mediocre is when I'm hiding behind the processes. Superpower or exceptional is when I choose to bring creativity, empathy, smiling, caring, thinking outside of the box, owning. Because there is no contract in any organization that can state that, Jason, you have to deliver 37 creative ideas in next month. It doesn't work that way. And no airline can force their flight attendants to smile sincerely. They can force them to smile, but not sincerely. Sincerely comes from the heart. And that's what organizations don't understand. That's my biggest struggle with CEOs, is when they come and tell me, I want to be customer centric. And I have to say, I have to go back to Susie from accounting. And he's like, who's Susie from accounting? I said, she's in charge of your strategy. And he's, no, she's not. I have a VP of strategy. I said, no, you don't understand. In a million ways, every phone call, every email, every meeting, every Zoom session is an opportunity for exceptional performance or mediocre performance. And the gap there is what I need to activate, which is making Susie from accounting find a purpose and activate her intrinsic motivation. And that's the difference between those type of things. We had a special measurement in our projects. We call them stories. We didn't measure customer satisfaction. In order to activate the profitability that we wanted, or the growth, or the retention, we actually measured how many employees chose to rise up and create stories that no one prescribed, but they chose to create. That's, for me, the ultimate measurement that the organization, the culture of the organization, is shifting toward exceptional performance and not mediocre performance.
Yeah, absolutely. You obviously, trusted advisor, being in a position where you can say to CEOs from all walks of life that you shouldn't be in the room because you're not giving it the right attention, and that maybe that VP isn't the person you need to talk to. Your career obviously has been an evolution and a journey. I'm wondering about whether there was a moment where people doubted your approach or told you that's not how to do it. How did you just keep pushing through because you knew that getting to Susie is the way forward?
I have a story for you, because all of us in the customer experience business, guys, you're in the change management business, and change is tough, and people are going to resist, and people will be cynical, and people will say it will never happen here. I'm going to tell you a story that is so extreme, but it's so telling. So we were doing business with an European company, and we were preparing our proposal, and we put a proposal out there for a customer study in 6 languages. And we got a pushback from the company, from the marketing department. We don't need it. We just need one language. We just need English. I said, it's Europe. We need it. No. We just need one language. And so we reduced the price and crafted the proposal the way it was. It was approved. Day one, we're designing the study. The same guy for marketing, I remember his name still, David, is telling me, I need 6 languages. And I look at him and I'm like, are you kidding me? I have an email from you saying that you need 6. And you said, no. He said, yeah, I know. I told you I only need English. And now I need 6. And I said, why did you do that? He said, because I don't want you here. And I knew you're going to lose money on 6 languages. So you're going to cancel the project. I want you out of here. So that's why I told you to do 1 language. So you lose money and you'll get out of here and you won't do the job. He's saying that in front of my teeth. And he was instructed by the VP of marketing to do that because they have the most to lose by what we will find. And they knew it. So that is an extreme case where the guy admitted to my face that he'd done that. We've gone, lost some money on those six languages because I told my team, we do not show up at the finish line with excuses. We show up with results and then we'll settle scores or do whatever we need to. The CEO, when he found out what happened on that day, he did two things. He fired David and he took 90% of the marketing budget and shifted it to sales and called it sales operation in order to penalize the VP of marketing. But that was the most extreme case. In between, you got a lot of pushbacks. And I'll tell you, the number one enemy to customer experience is not that people will say this is a stupid idea. You know what the number one issue is? People are saying, I'm doing it already. And I'm saying, if you're doing it already, why is your cost of acquisition going up? Why is your discounts going deeper? Why is your retention in the toilets if you're doing it already? But deep down, when people hear about customer experience and they don't understand it's also an operational change, they think it's just pixie dust that we're going to make people smile nicer and be compassionate. Guess what? They think they're doing it already.
Can you share perhaps a small moment or a gesture or a word, a detail that you've seen make a massive impact on the customer's experience, but for many people, it would just go unnoticed?
So I think that it's not just a moment, it's a guidance. Many organizations are so product-oriented and so product-centric that they fail to understand that it's guiding their decisions in the wrong way. And I'll give you one example. I was working with, I won't expose the name, but a certain competitor who we identified is suffering from an inferiority complex against their bigger competitors, okay? So emotionally, they feel that their market share is so slow and so low and the other guys are much bigger and everything else. It happens to be a Japanese player. And one day, we literally, in a workshop, I had to shake them up and I said, guys, I want to stop this conversation. You keep on repeating this thing. I have a question for you. How many customers are stepping into your stores and asking you for your market share? What role is market share playing in your customers' decisions to buy your products? And they were stunned because the answer was zero. But that is an example where companies are addicted to some external measurements that makes no difference to customers and make decision based on that instead of applying themselves. And that's where we needed to change the story. And we used, by the way, the element of the art of war in Japan. And we said, you're trying to be a sumo player, but you're a judo player. You're agile. You don't have the masses. For a sumo player to move takes a long time. You can move much faster. So stop showing up as a judo player on a sumo field and try to be what you're not. Be what you are, but be the best of that. And I think this is the part that companies miss the most. Customers buy you because of who you are, not because of your competitors. Be your authentic self. And I think this is the part that organizations miss. They love who you are, be the brand that you are, be authentic about it. And they keep on not realizing that at the end of the day, that authenticity, that human connection is what gets people connected. It's not the feature set. No product is perfect. And nobody cares about market share.
You remind me of a conversation that I've had many a time. And I'm sure you've had it as well. Are we measuring the things that matter? Market share, in your example, doesn't matter to a customer. I would argue that the NPS score doesn't matter to a customer either. But how should a company measure, in your opinion, the impact that they're having on their customers and their employees as a proxy, if you will, for future loyalty and repeat purchase?
First of all, the issue I have with NPS is that if you're willing to recommend, then give me the recommendation, then just give me the referrals. Then I don't understand why people do not convert that. And I'm yet to see one program that follow on the NPS scores and say, oh, these people rank us at 9 and 10. Let me ask them for that. I'll give them even an incentive. So for me, it's not about customer perception. It's about customer actions. Very simple. And to counter the product centricity of the four Ps, product, placement, promotion, and price, we actually counter that with a model of the five Ps of customer actions, which are strong preference for the product. That's the product that I want. I'm not RFPing that or bids or whatever. Premium price. Are you capable of commanding a premium price? Portion of budget. Am I capturing the larger portion of the budget for this category? Permanence of relationship. How long are you staying with me? And promotion to others? How many referrals do I actually receive? So when clients come to us and say, hey, we want to improve the customer experience, I would say, why? Did you make your numbers last year? Yes. So why are we doing this? And if we cannot touch this, one of those, then we have no conversation. Okay. I can tell you two main drivers that we find to be very important. The first one is what we call the money that we leave on the table. When you're product-centric, you're celebrating the one sale that you've done. You're not celebrating the full potential. So, for example, I work with a baby products company. You cannot take a baby out of hospital without a car seat. So you have to buy a car seat. And that was their average sale, a car seat, for about $150 or something like that. But when I look at their complete product line for parents over a three-year period, they really had $3,000 worth of merchandise to sell to them. And let's face it, parents don't get to return their baby if they don't like it. They're stuck with it for the next 3 years. Yeah. No, I said, stop looking at the customer as a $150 transaction. This is a $3,000 opportunity. How are you leveraging that? So the first measure that I look at is, can I move the needle within the full potential of the customer? That's for me. If I got them to buy the next one, the next accessory, the cross-sell, the upsell, it tells me that I've done something right here and I can move. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is longevity. If this is my average longevity, can I take it 1 year more, which is very valuable. So these are the two things that I can attach directly to the quality of the customer experience. And I can tell you that we've done specific, for example, in the cell phone business, we've done specific measurements that showed that if a certain transaction on a call center, on a customer service, have resulted with a certain NPS, I can see a spike in usage versus a drop in usage, and so on and so forth. So we have done research that can show us specifically the correlation to customer actions. And I think a lot of the CX professionals are either too attached to their customer perception measures or are afraid to own the real hard numbers. And therefore, when they come and ask for a budget and the VP of sales come and ask for a budget, he will win every day because he's committing to real hard numbers and they're committing to soft numbers. And the C-suite will say, I'll take the hard numbers over the soft numbers every day.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Would you say that moving the C-suite from a transaction to an opportunity mindset is the biggest mind shift change you've had to help C-suite leaders make, or is it something else?
So the first thing is, yes, this is a mindset. This is a mind-blowing thinking for them to look at, I'm leaving money on the table. I already acquired a customer and I'm not stretching it. So that was like, oh my gosh, we never really looked at the business that way. We never looked at it as a potential. The C-suite is going with a couple of other challenges. The first one is you look at the C-suite, many of them came from operational finance, which means their career was paved with Excel sheets, spreadsheets, pie charts, graphs. They don't look at customers as individuals. They're afraid to look at them. They think that they're an anomaly because the pie charts are telling them the story. And they don't understand that the moment it's aggregated, the pie chart, it's too late. So problem number one, skill set, not really aligned with humanity, and so on and so forth. Problem number two, again, short-term thinking allows them to go and think in terms of transactions and think that they will catch up later, but nobody showed them that the two are actually connected and are actually causing damage for the next quarter or the next year. So by not applying the economics of customer experience, we are not educating them correctly. They get a lot of stories. Disney have done that, the Ritz-Carlton story. And they look at that, they scratch their heads and they're saying, we're a B2B widgets company. We were not born that way. Maybe customer experience is just for people who are born that way and have Mickey Mouse. And we're not one of those. And I think that created a counter effect as opposed to encouraging them. It actually discouraged them. And then the last thing is skill set in actually conducting successful transformation. Many times the CX people are coming and say, we need to transform everything. This is a radical people process technology. They frighten the bejesus out of them. And they're looking at those CX people and they're thinking to themselves, when was the last time you've done such a thing successfully? Why would I give the keys to the house to you? What is your track record? And I think between all of these reasons, they will agree, but they will not commit the resources and the budgets because they're afraid. And I always say to CX leaders, you have to look at your CEO as a human being before they are a leader. And you're proposing something that frightens them, and you're not giving them the risk management and the confidence that they'll be successful. So they're not taking the baton and running as you wished for them to do, because you haven't done anything to build that confidence.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And I think it's so important for leaders to celebrate the successes from a number of angles and not just rolling out soft results, but also linking those soft results to the hardcore business results that at the end of the day, the shareholders are expecting, the bank wants, that you can take to the bank, so to speak. Leo, your work has spanned the globe, touched hundreds and hundreds of organizations and countless thousands of individuals. How do you want people to feel after they've interacted with you and your business and you've helped them transform? What emotional legacy are you hoping to leave behind?
I'll tell you a story. I had a CEO who approached me and he said, I want to ask you a question. Why didn't you fire us? We were a difficult client. We were kicking and screaming all the way. We were giving you a hard time. We were questioning everything you do. We could tell it wasn't fun. And I said to him, first, are you happy with the outcome? He said, oh, my people are performing at a level that I've never expected them. I did not know they're capable of doing that. I said, great. So we finished that. And I said to him, look, for you, this transformation was a first-time experience. For me, it's a journey I've been in for quite some time. I'm like the Sherpa that's helping you on the Everest. I've done this many times. So what was for you an existential threat, for me, was a milestone. And unlike you, I knew what's coming at the end of this journey. So I knew it was worth it, and I knew how to handle those milestones. And that's the first thing. And second thing, I guess I believed in you more than you believed in yourself. And really what I want their emotional outcome to be is like, wow, I didn't know I can perform that way individually or as an organization. I want people to feel that they're rising up to a better version of themselves as an organization or as individuals than they ever believed that they can. That's what I would love to leave behind. That's the kind of feedback that we are getting from people, that the notion of wow. I'll share with you one another funny story. So I did a certain project for a company in crisis, and I had this sign that I'm not allowed to mention it in social media in any way, shape, or form because it's so confidential and so on and so forth. And the CEO was so blown away by the project that he went on LinkedIn and put my picture there. And I'm calling them back. You just read this sign that I drew that. You had that, and you're basically blessed. They said, at this point, all bets are off. You can tell people what happened. But I want people to just look at themselves, at their organization, and say, there's so much potential here, both from a customer standpoint, employee commitment standpoint. A lot of CEOs are struggling with a hybrid environment and how to get the most out of their employees. It's a new way of engagement. And if I get them looking at themselves and saying, we didn't know we could get there. Yeah, that's the emotional stage I want them to be in.
Fantastic. Now, for those listening or watching along at home, we're going to leave in the show notes all the links to get Dare to author Leo Averussi's latest book and, of course, how to follow his work. But before I let you go, I have one last question, and that's for our audience that's watching along or listening right now. Maybe they're a business owner or a team leader, or maybe it's Susie in finance, just someone that wants to make a difference. What's that one thing they should go and start doing today to start transforming the experience they create?
In every situation, in every request you get, there are two paths, the power you don't have and the power you do have. Make a choice to use the power you do have. And maybe the power you do have is just to smile and say, I understand. But choose the power you have. You were not brought into this situation to tell me what you cannot do. This revolution starts when people make the choice to focus on the power they do have and to activate it, as opposed to hide behind, like a victim, behind the power that they don't have. And everyone in the organization, including the CEO, have power that they have and power that they don't have. They just need to decide to activate the power that they have.
I love that. Activate the power that you do have. Today, we've had the absolute pleasure of having Leo Averussi with us. He's reminded us that customer experience isn't a department, it's a decision, one that starts with empathy and ends with impact. So here's your challenge. Pick one moment in your business today. Choose to activate your power and make a difference. And remember, when you transform the experience, you transform your business and the world around you. If this episode moved you, share it, like it, and don't forget to follow for more.